You know, Maria, I've got to figure out what to do with that. It might just be like I pull someone randomly out that always watches it. Or I find a script to go on like by myself. I mean, it's one of those where I've got the plan B has to start emerging here. You know what I'm saying?
Like even I'm laughing at how kind of fine that was there.
Yeah, well, you know what? You're a busy man these days working in a corporate business, aren't you? So you don't have the flex that you did previously.
Do you know what I was on? Do you know what I was on until 1 minute ago? I was in a meeting getting briefed about an event that I'm talking at on stage. I don't get people briefing me on these things. I just turn up and wing it. I'm getting like concierge treatment now.
Oh, is that from marketing? It's going to help you with that. Basically, they've got a bunch of people saying you've got to say this, that, or the other.
Well, it's more so. I'm getting like groomed. Whereas previously everything was DIY.
Yeah, that's the reality of it. Reality of working for a proper business. Not to say Can the Idea wasn't a proper business, but you know what I mean.
Exactly.
You know what I mean. But by the way, what's this free advertising there for iSims? That's like, you know what I mean. At one point, we're gonna have to start charging those boys. We're gonna have to charge those boys extra if you want to show up and do that. that's it. Take it off.
Go on. That's fine.
And I love iSims, by the way. I love them, but yeah, no good. All right. Listen. Welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. We're bringing it to you every Friday, no fail. It's episode 157. We've got a really exciting show here today because it is a topic that you and I, Adam, know nothing about: hiring at mega scale. And I think the ones that we know nothing about are the best because they're actually really educational. So what is it like to actually hire, you know, we're talking tens of thousands of people in a short time frame. Forget about the 50 or 60 recruiter headcount per year. We are talking mega scale. How do you do that? I've actually struggled to find people with this experience. I'm really delighted that we've got Kirsten and Thomas to join us later on this. Anyway, folks, a quick sound check as we usually do. For the folks on Crowdcast, can you just let me know whether you can hear me okay? Just give me some sign on the chat screen whether the audio is okay. We should be live streaming this on LinkedIn Live, Facebook, and on Twitter Live. So if you're in those places and you can hear me okay, give me a thumbs up. Let me know whether the sound is okay, folks. Okay. I told the time delay and everything. There's a few people I can hear it, including Thomas, which is good because he's actually going to be on the show. Let's talk about one of our sponsors. I want to just thank you firstly for our good friends at Willow. They are a company that has been a great supporter of Brain Food. And they're a Scottish business, really impressive organization. They do async video interviewing for recruitment agencies. And I think I wanted them to be part of this particular show because hiring at scale, I think, needs this sort of asynchronous. You know, you need these types of tools to help you do it. There's no question that asynchronous interviewing has been a huge impact in terms of reducing recruiter effort and recruiter time, especially when you're dealing with high volume. So if you're an agency recruiter and you're not using any kind of, you know, video tool, do check out Willow, willow.video. I'm going to share the link in the stream below. They've been a really successful company in a very short space of time. And I think they are a really fresh company in this space. So do check them out, willow.video. Let's get on with the show. So Adam Gordon, how are you? How was your week?
I'm very good, thanks. And it's been a very good week. And I actually had dinner. I actually was sitting next to the founder of and CEO of Willow at a dinner last night. Complete coincidence. Yeah, Ewan.
Cool. Ewan Cameron, how are you doing, Ewan? Hope you're tuning into this one. He's a really good dude. Was that a Scottish thing, like a Scottish list, all the Glaswegians together or something?
Yeah, it was called the Turing Fest. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's like part of the it's part of the Edinburgh Festival, I think. Anyway, tech festival, and I was at the Turing Fest founders dinner in Glasgow last night, and I wasn't actually intending to go, but I got a message from a guy called Rich Wilson, who runs gigged.ai, it's a platform for, you know, it's for temp tech workers, effectively. He messaged me and asked if I was going. I said no. And then Ewan asked me the next day if I was going. And I went, actually, hang on. Two people have just asked me in 2 days. I should just go. So I just booked a ticket a few hours before and went.
Cool.
So, yeah, all good. That's great. I tend to not go anywhere, actually. I think I told you I've become really quite insular. However, I did go to that and it was quite fun.
Yeah, you need to. You need to get out of the habit. Haven't we all been that way, folks? So sort of since the COVID era, we've got very, very comfortable in our sweatpants and just sitting in the on the sofa and just like relaxing. I think that's definitely the case. But you and there's good reason to want to relax. But at the same time, you have to just force yourself to go and see people. You know, you're obviously thinking about public health in advance and all that type of stuff, but you just got to go and do it. Last couple of weeks, I've been in Berlin last week, New York just earlier this week. It was fabulous. I mean, I'm really tired now, but it was really fabulous meeting people that I haven't seen for 2-3 years and meeting new people that I never see. So yeah, it's been great. Go out and support events. Okay, good to hear about that, Adam. Let's. Do you have time to read the newsletter last week? And if so, what was interesting for you, man?
Yeah, I did. So the first thing was the top 10 strategic TA and HR metrics that CEOs want to know about.
Yeah.
This was a piece of content pulled together by Vizier. And I think what it does is it helps if you're a TA manager, a TA leader who hasn't yet worked out how am I going to get that coveted seat at the table, then you have to read this because this is the language that CEOs talk and this is what they want to know about. It's not cost per hire. It's not time to hire. I think these are actually really important metrics, but they couldn't care less about that. What they can care about is revenue per employee. What they can care about is the improvement of performance of new hires, like the time to performance, indicating, yeah, we're getting the right people in the business here. The performance of, or the amount of people leaving the organization in senior hires because of performance issues. And the number of dollars lost. This is Danny's kind of metric. The number of dollars lost because people haven't been in seat. There's empty chair time.
Empty chair.
And they might unfilled vacancies. You know, so we need to work out what our like ATS or CRM data is telling us. And we need to then start actually thinking about it in terms of what does the CEO want to hear about? And that way we're going to achieve influence.
We should actually do a metrics show on this. Again, I'll be struggling to find people that know too much about it because, and if you do, by the way, just let me know. Let me know in a comment wherever you are, whether you know anything about TA and HR metrics, because I think it is absolutely telling that we end up presenting sort of domain specific metrics that mean something to TA, but it doesn't land with the CFO, it doesn't land with the CEO. Or if it does, it asks them to have to process what that means. You know, what does time to hire mean exactly? I don't know. You know, use the language that they understand. Don't ask them to come to you. You've got to go to them. And this post from Vizier, they just introduced 10 metrics, which I thought you don't have to just use them verbatim, but they just give you an indication. You know what? A mindset shift will suddenly tell you the different sorts of things you can start measuring. Which may actually have a much more significant impact in the health of the business and therefore really elevate the conversations that we may end up having with sort of C-level. Because, you know, how long have we been talking about seat at the top table? You know, ever since HR and TA have been a thing, right? So we obviously need to progress from that. Have a read of this blog. I think it's a really important one, not only for the content directly, but also for getting you thinking about how other people think in the business and what's important to them, not what's necessarily important or relevant to us. Could be there should be two sets of measures, like one thing for our internal operations, and then maybe another thing for the wider business in terms of business impact. But yeah, maybe it's definitely worth a brain food life. Okay, cool. What else, man?
So Dr. John Sullivan's, that's great branding by him, by the way. I never call him John Sullivan. I don't think anybody does. They only ever call him Dr. John Sullivan.
is he actually a doctor? He's so respected in the industry. He's so respected in the industry. No one ever challenges him on his doctorate. Yeah. But I'm sure he is.
Like Professor Green or something.
That's it.
Maybe. So his article, which was, if you're like, you know, just a caution to the people who are immediately going, yeah, I've got to work remote. I'm not working in an office. And I appreciate the devil's advocate aspects to this. So what he's said is basically a manager's familiarity with you increases your career opportunities. So you're going to get more job opportunities. You're going to get more formal interactions. You're going to get more high quality development options, you know, and things like that. I don't disagree with that, but are the managers actually there to you know, get all of this? And second of all, there is a lot of context in here which I just don't agree with. So the most memorable communications are face-to-face. The most memorable interactions are face-to-face. That's one of them. I just don't know that they are. It says, like, you know, you need to meet face-to-face in order to measure those, like, subtle, body, you know, language and stuff like that.
Micro expressions and stuff, yep.
I get your micro expressions on Brain Food Live every single time we're on it.
Yeah,
I get micro expressions and body language on Zoom.
I've got a very expressive face, though, Adam, as you can see, you know.
Lots of muscles going on here.
No, yeah. Listen, I totally get what you're saying. I think Dr. J there is like has adopted the devil's advocate position, and he's kind of like steel manning the idea of, you know, staying back in office. I think you can disagree with his argument. However, I think fundamentally it's about proximity bias, isn't it? Yeah. You know, the idea that if you're in office, or it might be in office, but if your proximity in terms of communication, visibility is there with the boss or your immediate boss, it's going to be better for you, basically,
yeah,
because the trust has just increased. So I think it's a worthy thing to think about. And like I say, you'd hate for people to think, oh, I have to go into the office in order to develop my career. I don't think that's what Dr. J is saying. But what he is saying is that this may just be an impact that you have to be aware of, and it's something you need to consider. By the way, I would say that this is not news to, like, at least half of the working population, particularly, mothers who had to kind of leave the workforce for a period. I think they've always been very conscious of this kind of impact that they had, that sort of the idea that out of office, out of mind, has always been a challenge and we've never fixed it. But now it's elevated into a wider problem, obviously, because now men have to experience this as well. So, ladies, I totally see where you may be annoyed by this, like what seems to be a non-revelation from Dr. J to you. But it has landed, I think, quite effectively to the Brain Food audience generally, because it was quite a controversial piece and much needed to elevate, just in the sense of, look, maybe this is an issue that we need to examine, because it's something we are all now universally wrestling with in a remote short hybrid setting.
Yep.
Cool. One more, man, before we get on with it.
So do you remember about 2 months ago or something, we did a show about, actually, I can't remember what the show was about, but it came on to employer branding. And I said, oh, it was to do with, like, should recruitment report into HR, stuff like that. You know, right. We had that long-term conversation, yeah. That one. So My belief is that employer brand is the most important. Everything else should be, everything else in HR and in TA and in the people space should be designed to make a better employer brand. And I don't mean a better career site. I mean to make people want to work for your company and want to stay working in your company.
Sure.
So I really enjoy reading articles where people are saying, if you want to grow your business, then you need to turn your employer brand into a growth driver, I think was the context of this. Mm-hmm. I don't know the guy who wrote this, but if you're interested in employer branding or you're interested in recruitment at all, you need to go and read this article, because it makes you think much more high level about our obligation in recruitment towards creating the best employer brand, which is going to drive the organization forward. And it also, to me, links to this whole thing about what are the metrics that CEOs want to know about. If I'm an employer branding and I can create a brand which brings in more better people, which increases profits or increases customers or increases, you know, effectiveness or, you know, achieves the mission better, then I'm doing the best job I can be. So great article. Really enjoyed it.
It's one of those from LinkedIn. LinkedIn occasionally, I think actually it's a bit unkind. I think they quite regularly produce some really interesting things. And I thought this was a non-cliched post on EB from LinkedIn. And they had some interesting concepts, particularly this idea that you should have a unified brand. So consumer, corporate, and candidate, you should actually have the same brand, like the same brand message, the same brand vibe. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but it was worth sort of discussing. Maybe it is appropriate for certain types of organization. Who knows? But yeah, I think anybody who's interested in EB or TA really needs to have a look at that and just digest on some of the things that were exchanged there. It was a good post.
So I think you absolutely should have that unified brand. And here's something that you might find quite interesting. Until 2012, B&Q's owner, Kingfisher, had never spent a penny on recruitment advertising. Their television adverts, so for anybody not in the UK, B&Q is a DIY store. It's a big shop, big shed shop full of DIY equipment. And their adverts featured typically older people in their 50s and 60s who were working there, like showing them around the shop and showing them what they did and, you know, that type of thing. Making it a friendly place to want to go and get good advice from intelligent people about your DIY stuff. They didn't have to spend any money on recruitment because those people saw themselves working there and went, yeah, I want to work there actually.
Do you know what? All paths may lead back to Rome on this, to misuse a yeah. phrase, but it's like, yeah. if you're just transparent, you know what I mean, about what it is you do, yeah. I just wonder whether that just solves all of the science of it. You know what I mean? Just show what it is you do. Totally. And that's going to have positive brand impact, consumer impact, you know, candidate impact. It's just like, hey, this is what we are. And then that seems to work. So that is the Rome that we all need to go back to. We're basically going to end up doing what probably very simple businesses have always done, because they never even thought about marketing. You know, the entire marketing journey has been going back to like a road of discovery to figure out, oh, crap, we didn't actually need any of this at all. But anyway, all right, let's get on with this, man. Before I bring on Kirsten and Thomas on, your views on mega scale hiring. I mean, do you suspect that it is mega different? And if so, how is it different from normal hiring that you've had experience with? I mean, can you speculate at least? Because I know we don't have the experience.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I think we're doing the show is because Kirsten and I were talking a couple of months ago, and I just went, wow, what you're doing is incredible. You need to come on Brain Food Live and tell the world about this. It is mega complex logistics. And as far as you'll hear from me regularly, like pretty much everything's got to be about a funnel, but it's got to be about channels. It's got to be about a funnel. It's got to be about automating as much as possible. The technology often makes less mistakes than humans do when dealing with very large numbers. So this is a very different form of recruitment. One interesting thing would be about like Amazon. Amazon have got this kind of, I think it's recruiterless system.
Yeah, super automated way of doing it. Yeah.
Super automated. And they don't actually meet a human until they turn up for the first day on the job. You know, that type of thing is a very extreme version of, I think, what we're talking about today. But it's a particular niche. It's not even a niche, but it is a specific skill set and thought process you need to be able to do this. And looking forward to hearing from Kirsten and Thomas.
Let's bring them on. One thing I will ask him is, can you just drop any recruiter into this? Generally, like, what priors do you need in order to do this? So let's bring Kirsten on. Let me just see if I can.
Well, just think about that. Of course, you can't just drop any recruiter in this, because this is all process, experience, and technology, I think. It's not like soft skills interviewing people and all that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of thought process needs to go into it.
I think we do talk a lot about, you know, the human element of recruiting, but when it comes down to hiring at this scale, like, is it that relevant, you know? Okay, there's Thomas at least. Thomas, good to see you, sir. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on the show. We have Kirsten as well. Amazing. Welcome, Kirsten. Okay, so let's do some intros. Thomas, as you came on screen first, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What it is you do?
Sure. My name is Thomas. I'm the Director of Global Workforce Growth at Getir, a quick commerce company, and responsible for hiring all our store staff across the globe.
Amazing. And you've previously had experience with all kinds of like mega businesses, haven't you? Like TomTom, I think back in the day, and what is it, Just Eat you did, I think. So very interested to hear from all of your experience there. And Kirsten, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you and what it is you do?
I'm Kirsten, and I lead our global contingent worker program at Kantar. So data and research insights business with a particularly complicated contingent workforce.
Great, amazing. Let's start right from the spool it all the way back. When you first started your recruiting career, did you enter into a mega scale hiring scenario, or did you like do what all of us did and hire, you know, 30, 40 people a year, and then you find ended up going into a job that actually scaled up in this way? What was the path, a quick bio that you had? Kirsten, let's start with you.
I've never been a recruiter.
There we go. Revelations are going to keep coming. Let's hear
Sorry to break the news. No, I've always worked kind of within the how does it work, looking at process, looking at resource management. So my career started actually in resource management for professional services companies. So thinking about how do we deploy both internal and external resources into clients and so forth. And then moved into kind of the MSP world and then focus on sort of process tech, and predominantly I focus on building things to try and obviously get the engine running behind the scenes. But no, never actually physically recruited. I don't think I've ever made an offer to someone either, unless it was in my own team, actually.
That's actually amazing. And I love that angle straight away, because I can see how in PS world, it is all about making sure projects are adequately resourced. So you look at the business requirement, it could be, I don't know, the government of Indonesia wants to relocate the capital somewhere, and you're saying, right, okay, like how many people do we need to do that? What is required for this job? And it's, I can immediately say any experience I've got is completely irrelevant to that. You know, I would not be able to apply any kind of value. So I totally love the sort of the background you're coming from. Okay, Thomas, let's go to you. What's your journey been like? Quick spot bio. Like, when did you first enter the idea of hiring at this mega scale?
So I started long ago as a staffing consultant for a temp agency doing... And I'm an old man, so that was running to the fax machine, trying to get the resumes over to a call center as quickly as possible, right? So if you talk about volume, it was about how many pieces of paper could you stuff down that fax in one send. Dating myself horribly here, but there you go. So that's where I started. Then thought that tech recruitment would be really cool, and wanted to be a cool kid. So built quite a career in tech recruitment, and at some point, 5 years ago, made the switch into proper high volume and found out that it's both more challenging and more rewarding at the same time.
Very interesting. Let's start with that idea of it being super challenging. What are the challenges, would you say, that come with this type of scale? I mean, how is it different from like normal recruiting, quote unquote?
So I think for context, right? So I'm responsible for shop staff. So I have two roles year round. Shop assistants and bike riders. And I have to do those at ridiculous volumes, thousands a week sometimes, right? That's what we're talking about. And that's not necessarily the same everywhere, right? You can do high volume in other types of fields where maybe it's a little bit more complex. The challenging thing is that, like, even though you have those two jobs, they mean something different in every country that we operate in. In the UK, I struggle to find people that can actually ride a bike safely.
This is a Dutch guy criticizing British riding technique. You know, Thomas is from the Netherlands. So,
in case you couldn't tell before. And in Spain, they thought that we were scamming them, because they were like, wait, are you paying me to ride a bike in the sunshine? This can't be real, right? So it's a very different, you know, you don't have that luxury of putting a lot of culture and growth and that type of thing in an employer brand. It's by nature a more transactional relationship. People do it for very different reasons, and these peaks just happen. And I'll argue that a great bicycle career is more scarce and more difficult to find than a software engineer any day.
That's really interesting. Really, really interesting. Coming to you, Kirsten, sort of, what do you think are the challenges at scale? Like, what have you encountered that you think are different that other people who don't do your job are not aware of? You know, what's the most prominent thing in your mind when that question comes up?
I think for me, it's slightly different because I'm engaging with a contingent workforce. So my key drivers are pace, but also I'm then kind of handicapped by compliance at the same time, because I can't just go out to the talent pool and say, right, come in on Monday, start a role. We need to ensure that whatever country that they're working in, we have employment and tax compliance, and also the relevant checks, et cetera, are done. So my issue is kind of the window I have of, I need the person to start to do one day's work, even that amount of work, whilst ensuring that we can pay them compliantly and they're contracted compliantly, and even to the extent of they've had the relevant background checks that will need to be done, because it's very, very on demand, turn it on, turn it off. So the biggest challenge is making sure that it's not red tape, it's making sure that it's done correctly, but actually making sure that it is done correctly.
So the sense I'm getting from the pair of you is that it's basically unpredictable when the surges occur, or if it does happen, it's a very short runway. It's not something where you start in January and you think, right, we need 10,000 people by the end of the year. It's more like that might have been the conversation in January, but come in May, it's like, oh, we now need 5,000 in this place or something like that, because then new projects come in or something has affected the business or the market in some way. And then you're the person that is in charge of that and has to resource it.
I think for us, I think for me, it's, you know, I have an indication because of obviously past data, because we're lucky enough to be able to have a really strong workforce planning team and they do lots of data crunching, all that good stuff, which is fantastic. So we kind of see that. I think the nature of the resources is, you know, they're engaged to deliver a service or a project and so forth. So attached to that is in a sales cycle and a sales window to then say, right, now we're going. So it's, and often quite similarly with that environment, we get, okay, we now need someone externally because we've don't have anybody internally to obviously do the opportunity. So it's that, it's not really, I wouldn't say it's not the visibility, it's or the predictability. It's really just the window, because we could potentially predict headcount based on sales cycle and pipelines, etc. But again, that's just a really difficult thing to do. And then we're putting in energy where we don't need to. I think it's more around actually working with the business closely and trying to understand from them what is the sales window so that we can factor that into our cycle times and things like that.
What would you say is the immediate thing that happens when you get an understanding of the requirement? So I'm not talking about business as usual, but when there is something that occurs, right, Thomas or right, Kirsten, this is what we now need. Like, what is there like a lever you pull and something happens? Like, is there a pre-designed plan that can be deployed, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So it is for us, right? So I think, so I do both contingent labor and permanent staffing, right? Because, and they're each different levers. So if I launch a new country or a new city, I open up a new shop, then there's a standard off the shelf plan. I go like, right, this is my marketing plan. This is how I go. And it's just, you know, there we go. But my time to hire that my commercial team expects of me is 5 days, right? So they tell me 5 days in advance and then go ahead. That's, you know, it's not just high volume, it's high speed as well. And in that 5 days, I have to decide, am I going to go with my standard launch plan? Do I not trust it? Then I go to some agencies and I tried to, you know, how do I do that? It was interesting because I think what you and Adam were talking about before Kirsten and I came on was around those metrics, right? So around those, and I typed in the chat even then, it's about, for us, it's about life cycle value. Right now, the biggest inhibitor of Getir's commercial growth is the lack of workforce, right? So we can typically, you know, sometimes run into the problem of not being able to open a store or not being able to deliver particular shifts because we don't have the people in place. So we have a whole set of scenarios planned that immediately trigger either a marketing campaign or a buying process with one of our agency partners. So there's a myriad of things that we can do to very quickly push on campaigns and all of the subsequent work that needs to be done to get someone on a bike.
How do you know those plans are going to work? Have they been market tested in a certain place, or is there just a get here? It's kind of a formula that you roll out irrespective of what market there is. How much is this? Is how confident? When you say confidence, how can you have confidence if it's a new launch? Or
Hang, if I tell you that, I lose my job, right? Like my boss is listening in here. No, but all joking aside, the reason why I said before it was more rewarding is because the size is so much bigger. So you can actually do statistical analysis and say with some security, like, hey, this is going to work, right? And that's, you know, whether you're an employer brand or in recruiting, that's always the tough thing. You have to sort of estimate on a sample size that is never quite big enough to really sort of consistently say, like, I know that I'm always going to be able to deliver. Over the last 5 years, I've been responsible for more than 90,000 high volume hires. That's what I'm talking about. Not taking all the claim, but that, you know, sort of under my organization's that's what I've been responsible for. And so that gives me a lot of data baggage that I can then use to sort of start planning out, okay, you know, I know this works, I know that doesn't work. Obviously that's different when you enter new countries or new territories, but in the basic premise, we roughly know how people are going to respond and to what.
Can I just ask about the concept of like life cycle value? What we were talking about earlier when we were talking about the metrics that CEOs want to know about is really how much money am I making from people? Presumably, this is the way that you need to think when you're a cyclist in Barcelona is going to deliver me X amount of money every month or whatever it is. And they're likely to stay with us for 4 months. So therefore, I need to do this. And that informs everything you do. Is that right?
It goes a little bit beyond that, right? Like I can even calculate how much more efficient a rider becomes over time. So I know that, you know, they have a time to competence. It takes them a while to get up to a certain level. And then they sort of flat out. And funnily enough, we found recently that, yes, they flat out. But after 6 months, then suddenly they spike up a level and they flat out again. And then after another 6 months, they go up and out again. So we're looking at, really at it from that perspective. Like, how can we maximize the amount of value that we get from an employee? And we can do that by doing recognition campaigns, right? So my employer brand team, for example, has a loyalty team in under it that really just works on how can I keep this rider happy, engaged, excited to be there, you know, with a feeling of recognition, so as to make them do their best job.
So this is what we would refer to in like as in software sales. Anyway, would you refer to it as LTV? It's customer LTV, long-term value, lifetime value. Kirsten, is that the same type of thing for you as well? Is this the way that you go about measuring what you're doing?
Slightly differently, because mine is normally measured backwards. So from we're looking at when we need the person, and then we're counting backwards to say whether we delivered the resource in line with when the requirement was. So we kind of do that calculation from a time perspective. As I mentioned, we have a quite different, if you look at our contingent workers, we have our typical IT contractors through to people who are doing creative projects, research, like, and all sorts. So it does mean that we also have a different tech stacks in place. So back to your question around the trigger, like the trigger for me is technology, but predominantly that's the first start of the process. With some of our resources, we then use more of a like a rating, if you will. So kind of more of that service that they delivered. We do like a performance evaluation, a bit like a checker trader in some respects around what they've delivered, which is a good indication of us then being able to re-engage that resource the next time.
Okay. Talking about technology, really interesting. We might as well sit on this a little bit, because I assumed coming into this that actually there may need to be a very different set of technologies to hire at scale at this type. Or is it the case that the same technologies can be scaled up? I mean, what technologies are going to get you 10,000 people or 5,000 people in 5 days? Well, I take that's just a mass marketing campaign, isn't it? Like, you got to just crunch out, blast out a bunch of Facebook ads or something. Thomas, you want to talk about the acquisition tech that you use?
Sure. So the funny thing is that especially with this type of high volume hiring, right? So this workforce type of hiring, it's not just cranking out a Facebook ad or doing, you know, buying some Indeed and then looking for it. What I manage my team on is conversion percentage. So how big a percentage of the people that apply to a job with us actually make it onto a bike, right? That's the goal. We have a lot of research that suggests that speed of hiring is actually a significant contributor to conversion, right? So to give you an idea, the previous employer, we were trending at sort of 10 days hiring, 10 days between sort of applying and then the first job of a bike, first sort of shift on a bike, and at a conversion rate in sort of the low 20s. Then we sat down, got really angry at ourselves and tried to turn it into 24 hours, and we did. So we did the entire recruiting process in 24 hours and offered someone the chance to get on a bike tomorrow if they so desired. They could also pick next week, but they could go on a bike tomorrow. Conversion spiked at 65%. Same wow. same spend, same channels. So actually, you know, again, this is what I talked about before. The scale becomes so large is it's no longer about spending more with money, but making sure that you get the most out of what you get in. So that's really cool. And so, you know, we operate, you know, you mentioned Amazon and their sort of recruiterless hiring. So we use the same tools that they do. Fountain is a very specific high volume ATS doing really well and is really strong at helping us, you know, sort of closing that into that 24 hour mark and making sure that we automate as much as we can. You know, we find, and I think that's true. If I put my old school TA hat on, right? Like if you think about what the most wastage is in your recruiting process is that time between interviews, it's that fussing of hiring managers thinking about, you know, should I, shouldn't I, you know, maybe I should look at another CV. And then the other thing is the paperwork, right? Like I need to get a copy of your passport and, you know, all that stuff. And I think you can do a lot of that simultaneously, right? And I think we do it very sequentially in the industry. And there's so much cool stuff that you can do to increase speed.
That sounds fascinating. I want to just sit on a few ideas there. And Chris, now I want to know whether your view on this aligns with Thomas's. But what I'm getting from this is that actually for contingent working and this high volume type of working, typically it's actually a hyperactive job seeker. So we, in recruiting world, we talk about passive and active, and we kind of measure, you know, how motivated people might be for jobs. And then we spend a lot of employer branding, whatever, to get people more motivated. But perhaps in this hyper growth, the people are hyper motivated. Like they just want this job. They want the money now. And if you can offer them this like tomorrow, they will turn up because that's actually why they're actually talking to you. You know, they're very keen to do it. And if you say, if you kind of have a delayed start date, they may well be actually going to a competitor, or they may well be like, yeah, I mean, it's no good for me, this job next week. I actually need 7 days worth of work right now. So, so you got to close the time between having the job opportunity, them interacting, and then getting them actually paid, getting them to do a job that you can pay them on.
We did some. Go for it.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Chris.
Ours is slightly different in the sense of, because we have different types of contingent workers and we've got really different channels. So some of the channels will be a case of we put a request out and then within that day, someone's already accepted the work and they're completing the work. Whereas on some of the other channels, we're having to go through your more typical recruiting model with our suppliers and so forth. So I think it depends for us personally on the type of the contingent worker coming in. But I also think for the bulk of our volume, it's individuals who do this kind of as their full-time job, and then they're working for other organizations. So they're always kind of putting their hand up to accept opportunities, do pieces of work, and it's a distinct piece of work, and then they'd come back and redo it. So a lot of it is about also the engagement for us and making sure that we are being transparent and going out with the opportunities and so forth. And then it's down to them to say whether they are available and open to do the work.
I think that's a very key point. So my understanding is starting to grow a little bit. I was going to say grow massively, but it hasn't. It's just grown a little bit. But it is like, okay, the sort of job is critically important. And I just like connected the idea of like mega scale with the idea is basically, I don't want to say low skill because it is definitely skill to do get on a bike and deliver stuff. But it's not like specialist skill where it's like inaccessible to others where you need loads of training. You just need to have that one thing similar to
it's not, Kind of, but the difference for us is also a lot of resources are known to us. So because of the nature of kind of doing kind of that research or stuff like that, they'd be known and therefore they'd be that trusted like resource to us. So we are, that's that on that side of the business, it's about focusing on getting the work done and the task done. The person who's doing it is not necessarily that important. It's about ensuring that the opportunities gets completed and the client's work gets done and so forth. In our normal world, whereby we have got the IT contracting, of course, that is more kind of, it takes time. It's about the interviewing pieces and so forth. But from a time perspective, the difference is in our contingent world, in our IT world, we're going through like your typical recruiting process. Whereas in our kind of like more of our freelancer world, we're not necessarily like recruiting them and we're not interviewing them. We're just saying, oh, we know that you're good. We're going to re-engage with you because you've done work with us before or because we can see you've got opportunities and so forth. So it's very different because we don't therefore have any lags to say, oh, we're going to check that you're great and then have to do a four-stage interview process or anything like that. So the selection part in the middle actually really influences the timescales and the ability to turn it on and off quickly.
Yeah, I think that's where the time comes from, isn't it? Like the yeah. Uncertain in normal recruitment, it's uncertain about this person. Therefore, we stack it with loads of events to try and increase our confidence. I mean, assessment, whatever, all that kind of stuff. Whereas what you're saying is, I guess there's two things there. Number one, known resource, we can actually scrap a great deal of these. But on other stuff where it is unknown resource, but maybe their skill set is testable in a different way. Maybe they have some badge or some level of competence for their trade. We can accept that as evidence that they know what they're doing. We get them on it. I don't know how you do it on bikes, actually, Thomas. I mean, how do you know they can ride a bike? Do you test for this or what?
We prefer people with driver's licenses, for example, right? Where we
of
can.
Of course, yeah.
And depending on the country, we do bicycle tests. England, mostly.
Tell me you put them on a BMX track or something, yeah. Or a half pipe.
I wish I could. And we do a lot of safety training, right? Training before they start around, this is how you navigate this particular city. These are the traffic rules.
It would be physically impossible to validate whether they can ride a bike, though, right? I mean, there's an element where, maybe someone can tell me. How do you assess for bike?
Cycling proficiency test. We all did it in primary school.
You did?
No one has this document, do they? I mean, there's no record of this. I'm just saying, look, if I applied for this job, let's say I saw a Getty job, I applied for it. I don't think you shouldn't trust me on the roads for sure. But would I pass through? Like, how would you screen me out, Thomas, is what I'm trying to say.
So again, it differs a lot per country because in some countries, there's actually a law that says that, yes, we do have to do a proficiency test. And it's even validated by an external examinator in some countries, right? So it does exist. The countries that don't maybe could benefit from one of those things. But most of it, again, is a lot of training, but after you're hired, right? So we hire you, then we train you, and then you go out into the world. Only after your training and a couple of rides with a buddy will you get sort of let loose on your own, just to make sure that you're safe and that you're...
Got it. So it could be that, okay, there's a basic level of competence, but then you pay the person, their own employee or whatever it is at that period of time, they've got a contract, and then you may spend a week or a day or however long it is to train them up to speed before they're actually, as you say, ramped up and productive as a delivery person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We didn't have people applying though. So the concept of applying for us doesn't, in the contingent space, of course, doesn't really exist because... unless it's, as I mentioned, like a typical IT contractor, where all the volume isn't an application, it's more a case of, yes, I'm available. Yes, I can complete the work that you're looking for within this at a time. Yes. And it's an availability rather than a skills assessment or an application to actually complete the work. And that's also due to like the known talent and the talent pools that we draw from. So I think that works in our favor because we're already going to a pre-existing known network. Coming back to the compliance piece, they all have some form of contractual piece in place already. So we kind of like have a long-term, yes, we can get you. but we also then need to pay them. So coming back to the tech piece, we have a tech piece to kind of go to them to give them the opportunity, but then we have a subsequent tech piece, which is either to get them paid in a compliant way, and also if they then need to use any of our systems, there's another kind of like step to it. But if the individual is already set up for payment, is already available from a work order perspective and so forth, it really is just a case of can you do this tomorrow? Can you do this on Monday? And especially if they don't need IT access, it can be that quick. But that's also like the luxury of having a talent pool, which I'm not responsible for and I didn't build, because it's been grown through however many years that the businesses have been in place. And the one thing I would say for us is that I feel like I have a shared responsibility. So it isn't solely my responsibility to ensure that this person can start on Monday or these tens of thousand people can start on Monday and do their role. We share that with the business because they're the ones who are directly then engaging with them, completing the work and so forth. So I kind of do the bit behind the scenes to make sure we know who they are and they're paid. But from a responsibility of knowing who they are as well, that's a shared thing with the business, which really does help.
Yeah,
I think that's so cool.
So this talent pool is amazing. It's probably the dream of all companies, isn't it, to be able to build. So how do you handle GDPR? Number one question, because isn't the entire idea of GDPR you can't hold this data, or you've got to keep they've got to keep reconfirming every 6 months or so that you are entitled to do it. So is there a system to kind of make sure that they're happy to be in this pool and happy to be present and their data held in the company?
It's mostly attached to our contracts. So we've got a freelancer management system, a vendor management system, all of these wonderful things. And those start and end dates drive basically the linkage on the contract and therefore what's in the clauses of the contract with reference to data and so forth. So I'm not having to have to kind of do a refresh and so forth, because also the contract itself is what then gets refreshed with the data privacy and all those components in there.
Well, they want to be there as well. It's in their interests to be there. It's part of their supply chain for getting, paying for
them. Let me just say on that point.
Just on the freelancer management system, the individual themselves, it's their, if you will, it's their account. So so that's their data with the technology provider. If they don't continue to update their profile and agree to those terms of their data being within that system, then they can't actually have access to it and therefore they can't get the opportunities. So when they in essence have a profile on the platform and then book through the profile. But if they don't maintain that and give that consent, then they can't be on the profile on the platform.
Yeah, I think for the GDPR is basically designed for non-contractors anyway. I think it's designed for like people who traditionally on permanent get pissed off with agencies sort of emailing them all the time. We've rolled it out to everyone. But as you say, people who are always looking at interim or always on that interim market, they have no problem whatsoever in being on that database because it means work. So it's kind of like GDPR, and in fact, I would say all privacy related rules that are there to so-called protect the privacy of workers and individuals is basically a crude tool that's optimized for a certain category of person, but it sort of potentially negatively affects a great a sweep of other folks out there as well. Let's talk to you about the skill set required to do this job. As a recruiter that's doing a normal quote-unquote 360 recruiting job, 30 requirements a year, that kind of thing. What am I missing in order to be able to do this job or be part of the teams that you guys are on? Or is it doable? I mean, is this something that is actually, you can take a recruiter with these more generic skills and actually apply them in a role here? Or is it a different type of person? Thoughts on this? Go to you, Thomas, first.
It's a different job. I tend to hire from telesales departments rather than from recruiting departments, because for us it's really about sort of pulling people through. You talked about speed before. I mean, another little tidbit of analysis that I can give you is that we found that when we did a candidate survey that 80% of our applicants have at least five other applications running. So I'll repeat it. It's shocking. 80% of our applicants had at least five other jobs in that very moment that they were applying for. So the people on our teams are constantly going like, hey, Adam, I'm still waiting for you to upload that copy of your passport. Don't forget, I've got this exciting opportunity for you. And if you want, we can book in your shift straight away, right? So it's where I think a classic TA recruiter sort of pushes someone through the funnel, like, right, okay, one step further, do something, you know, jump through a hoop, and then one step further. We're sort of dangling that carrot at the finish line, saying, come on, come with us. We've got everything. Look, red carpet laid out. Come join us. This is why you should join us over this other role, right? Our recruiters go out and talk to people about why it's cooler to work for purple than it is for blue. In the very immediate impact, they talk about the financial benefits of doing that. So they're doing sales.
And it's telephone based. Just a quick sec, Kirsten. And it's generally telephone based. Like a significant portion of the recruiting time of your recruiters speaking to these riders is actually old school telephone stuff.
No. So the majority is automated, and then the very last bit of it is a phone call. Just very tiny bit.
Cool. Quick one on the automation. What sort of technology are we talking about here, Thomas?
So all of that is still built up in Fountain with lots of integrations, right? We have Twilio accounts to make sure that we can send WhatsApps and cool campaigns and that type of stuff. We have Jumio integrations so that we can do cool identity verification stuff and a whole slew of other things to further make quick and attractive that process.
Yep, got it. Sorry, Kirsten, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think. In my role in particular, because there is actually there's no recruitment that really happens. It's really focused on, it's actually more focused on the process and actually more boringly on the compliance components, because it's, you know, getting the talent and all those elements, being able to turn it on enough. But actually, if we don't turn it on enough compliantly, then we shouldn't be doing it in the first place. So it's actually more regarding managing the process to get the process from A to Z, and also making sure that we've ticked all the right boxes. There is recruiting that happens in some areas of the business, but actually we have, you know, again, we have a team of people who support that, but they facilitate it because they're not interviewing or anything like that. They're just kind of like facilitating. It's the working with the business to get the person engaged rather than necessarily doing the recruiting or going out on advertising or anything like that, because that doesn't happen.
Yeah, Kirsten, yeah. What do you do around managing that community? Because inspiring that community and keeping them engaged, is that something you need to do? Do you see like engagement levels dropping off if you don't keep in touch with them, or what happens?
It happens in two ways at the moment, and we are on a journey to make it one way. So the first way is through the use of our freelancer management system, because you know the people are contained in there, and that's how we can do the on and off bookings and so forth. But outside of that, it's very kind of business black book, massive black book, like files and files of black books, but it's very business black book orientated. So our journey is to combine the two and then think about how we can use a CRM and bring them all in, which will mean right when we get to that point we do need to do the added complexity of data and so forth. But the intention will be that we amalgamate the two into a CRM, and therefore we turn on some form of talent ecosystem and use the goal is to kind of repurpose in some respects like your typical landing pages and kind of like survey type pieces like through a CRM to maybe not have the freelancer management system in place. So that's the journey that we're on, and at that point in time it will be a case of, you know, this is the opportunity, but also then we'd like to team up more with not only our business, but also our brand team about like Kantar as a business, full stop. But it's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do because there's not only the data, but like who's going to interact with it is important, but that's the ultimate goal.
What about you, Thomas?
Can I just respond to that? Because remember when I said that it's more challenging and more rewarding? I think for the mastodonts in this industry among us, you'll remember that 5 years ago or something, there was this great big hype around recruiting turning into community management, and no one actually had the scale to do it, except for Kirsten, right? I talked to you about the coolness of having such vast volumes that suddenly setups like building that community and building that black book and building those relationships suddenly work. So Kristen, I'm bloody jealous. That sounds super cool.
Yeah, but they're not mine, don't forget. I haven't done the work to get them. If I had to start from nothing, blimey, it would take a very long time.
Yeah.
It's just about the nature of our business, that that's how we work. And we have that, and like, we're lucky. And again, they are business owned. I think that's the key thing. It's a business owned talent pool. And what I'd like to be able to do is help them engage it quicker, but ensuring that it is compliant.
But this is the value of a business that builds that relationship. I'm sure Kantar have got a very strong brand within the community of people that are happy to be in those places. Because if you provision sort of good quality jobs for these people, then of course you're going to be very welcome towards them. Does the same community management attitude apply to bikers, Thomas? Or do they think of themselves as community, or is it very much, you know what, I've got to do this job for 3 weeks or 4 months or whatever, my career is elsewhere, I don't think along these lines. What are your thoughts on community management for a different type of work?
So we actually segment our workforce quite dramatically, right? So we talk about the rider as one job, but we identify four different set types of people that work in there and that work there for different reasons, right? So some of them are just in there for a couple of weeks because they, you know, or they want to make a couple of extra bucks. But we also really have that segment of students in our driver pool who will ride full time during the summer, not at all during exam season. And so, you know, there's a lot of that going on. So the answer is a yes for certain segments. We pick and choose who we build long-term networks with. Yeah.
So I was going to ask a similar question to Hung, but the way I was going to ask it was, what proportion of the hires that you're making are like one-off, they'll come to us once and then we probably won't see them again, versus like repeat purchases? And you kind of answered that question. I wonder if you have the ability to work with people in different places. So somebody's in London for 6 months and then they're in Prague for 6 months or whatever it might be. Is that something you would do?
Oh, we do it. I don't know that that happens enough to build any sort of real sustained process around it, right? Like, I don't know if that's a business case where I'd go, yeah, that's where I invest my money. But yeah, absolutely. I think there's, you know, we have a good majority of our people take their job at Get Your very serious. It's their primary source of income. That's how they provide for their family. You know, then we've got a group, let's call them sort of platform workers, people that are suddenly without money, and need cash, but are not, you know, it's not their dream job. So that they come on and they work for us. And these are people that become unemployed, refugees, immigrants, those types of people that really make that choice. The funny thing is that they typically tend to give us an amount of flexibility in terms of when they work and how long they work that we like, because it translates well into the volatility of our business, right? Like we're very busy on Saturday night when everyone's beer runs out, and we're maybe a little bit quieter on Sunday morning when maybe everyone wants a bit of aspirin. Not joking, right? So that's how volatile our business is. So we, you know, the job for my teams is really, I have a separate team that actually looks at how do we mix those different persona. I'm not going to give you all of them, but we have eight of them. We have eight different persona where we say like, hey, they're all with us for very different reasons. And how many of each do we want in each city? And that translates directly back to what do we sell and when? And then, you know, we go like, okay, I know.
They're both running sales and marketing operations here. The difference is Kirsten's is a little bit more like a B2B kind of operation, and Thomas's is a bit more like a B2C operation. That's like it really is. It's good. I'm self-appraising my own analogy here.
No recruitment happening over here.
No, I mean, I think this is fascinating. And folks, before I realize the time, we're flying through this. Yeah, absolutely. Michael, you just prompted us. We always do this in the middle of the show, folks. So take a moment. We don't want sort of this conversation to end just because Brain Food Live has to come off air. So if you're interested in this kind of sort of conversation, particularly about high volume, mega high volume, take a moment and share your LinkedIn profile in the chat stream there or on the thread. threads on LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter, wherever you happen to be watching this, and make sure you then connect with other people that happen to be watching this as well. There are also people that are interested in this topic. And of course, connect with Thomas and Kirsten as well. I'm sure those two are folks that will be very valuable people to learn from on this topic. Okay, let's move it on to, I guess, the final couple of things. Learnings that you have learned from your own career path doing this type of work. What are the sorts of things that you could kind of give yourself advice on if you were to fly back in time 5-10 years when you started on this journey? What kind of things have you learned about how to do your job well that younger version of you could really have benefit from? Kirsten, you got any thoughts on that?
I think just due to the nature of my role, you need to be, I need to involve lots of different people to the party. I have to have a lot of invitations to the party to make it work. And I think historically I would have been like, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'm just going to get it done. And that's burnt me in the past. I think the key thing is for me personally, because of the nature of the workers, just making sure that the right people are involved, engaged, informed, so that I don't have any blockers for the pace, the compliance or anything like that. It's just kind of like having the upfront stuff.
Right. So just to summarize that, basically, because of the acuteness of the pace, you can't afford to have someone come in sort of midstream and say, "Yo, hang on, you know, this is not happening
because this isn't compliant. We can't pay tax, or we can't pay them right, and all this."
And relationship is clear to make sure that doesn't happen. I think that's a lesson that could be ported to anywhere, but it particularly acute with high volume. Okay, Thomas, how about you? Like one thing that you could advise your younger self about how to do your job better.
I think treat empty time as a black hole. Like, I don't get it. You know, I started this by talking about when I had a fax machine. I would allow my customer to sit on a German language call center agent in Amsterdam. And I'll tell you, those guys were scarce at that time to interview someone else. And the person would be waiting. And it's just such a weird thing. And I think that's something I would teach any recruiter at this stage. Take all of the empty air out. There's so much empty space in our process.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think we've come to the end of time. Thank you so much, Thomas and Kirsten. It's been really educational speaking with you on this. Again, every time we do a Brain Food Live, I get a feeling that we should just do another, do a follow-up, because obviously there's not enough space to in the course of an hour to get through everything we need to get through. Thank you both for your time, folks. If you're interested in this, we'll have to get you back at some other point. But Thomas, Waldman, great to hear from you, sir. You have a very good weekend. And Kirsten, great to see you. Great to meet you. I don't think we've met before. So wonderful to make this connection here on Brain Food Live. Yeah, have a good weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye, guys.
It's a different world. What can I tell you? Different world.
I told you you'd enjoy that.
I'd love to have the opportunity to have done it. I mean, obviously now in my old age, I probably don't have the energy for it anymore. But the idea of actually trying to do all of those, I mean, I do like the fact that the mega scale gives you proper, it gives you enough data to be very, very confident in your predictions, that you can say. I mean, particularly when Thomas was talking about, you can see the ramp times as to when someone actually improves sort of in these kind of step changes. I wonder whether that's replicable in different sort of jobs as well, where there's a breakthrough moment where you realize, oh, now I know how to work within the system. You kind of get successful at the system. 6 months down later, you then understand, oh, now I know how to break the system and get even better. And then suddenly you accelerate further forward. Some fascinating things that we could possibly learn from all of this.
It's all sales forecasting. It's effectively the same thing. It's predictive analytics. It's looking at what have we done before. So therefore, what percentage of, you know, do we need to dial it up or dial it down in order to, you know, get the result we need? It's that concept of customer acquisition cost. Like, how much do you have to spend in different places to get the right, you know, results to fill all these jobs? Not so much in Kirsten's case. That's a bit different. That's very much about. It's about process, making sure people are available in the right time. That's logistics. It's air traffic control.
Yeah, and I think that situation where you have a pre-existing talent pool, which obviously just don't sit there exclusively, I'm sure they're working with other people, but if they're in there in some way and they're contactable for opportunity and they're not annoyed about that, that's just the dream's position to be in, isn't it? And you just wonder, is that sort of thing, how can we apply some of those lessons to some of the branding challenge we have? Anyway, that's about it, folks. So welcome. Thanks for watching. We'll be back next week. We've got loads of things happening next week. We've got two Founders Focus interviews with Ilya Brodsky, CEO of VanHack. That's happening at 4 p.m. BST on Tuesday. We've also got another Founders Focus with Victor Nord and Adrian McDonald, CEO and founder of Adway, who do recruitment automation, I think, recruitment marketing automation. So you'd be thrilled to see that, Adam, even though you won't be on screen. And finally, Brain Food Live back on Friday. What are we talking about? How to organize a sourcing jam. So this is the idea of, okay, we need to rapidly get some pipeline into, let's say we need to hire engineers real quick. How do you do that? Well, guess what? You can organize one day event or half day event and get your teams to help you source these people and rapidly get people a list built up. Make sure you join that if that's something you want to experiment with. Okay, that's about it. Thanks for watching, folks. Okay, that's it. So,
what are you doing this weekend?
I don't know, mate. I'm going to sleep. I'm so tired. I usually say this because I'm old, but I've been traveling like a maniac recently, last two weeks, and it just takes it out of you. You know, when you land, you think, oh yeah, I'm getting here at 6. No, by the time you're actually home and able to relax, it's like 10 o'clock already.
I try and avoid it at all costs personally, but
yeah, that's tough. So I've got like 2 weeks where I'm doing nothing. So I'm going to just spend that time really just, it's me time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How about you? What are you doing?
Don't know. I'm going to probably go to a couple of restaurants.
Football's over, isn't it? So, you know.
Well, no. Next week, we've got Scotland against Ukraine in the World Cup qualifier. So if we beat Ukraine, we're then on to Wales. And if we beat Wales, we're in the World Cup.
I totally forgot about that. Well, why did I think that Scotland were already in?
No, that's not true.
No.
Well, it might be unlikely we'll get in. I don't know. Beating Ukraine and then beating Wales in Wales.
So you've got to go. It's a two-legged journey to get there.
Yeah. I've actually got a hotel booked in Cardiff next Sunday night. It's next Sunday, just in case we win on Wednesday, whatever it is, against Ukraine. But
optimistic. Ryan, I need to look on what's happening in football. And obviously, you know, Ukraine, it's going to be a hugely emotional sort of event. I think a lot of people are saying, you know what, it'd be great to see Ukraine at the World Cup. And they do have some very good players that would, I would imagine, be hyper motivated to do well. So, be interested to see how it goes. It reminds me to get back into football, actually. Yeah.
All right.
All right. See you later.
See you soon. Bye.